4 years after their defeat in Super Bowl I, the Chiefs made it back to the big game. A lot had changed in that time. The game was becoming more popular, and the spectacle of it all was growing every year. But even in the midst of the marching bands, hot air balloons, and battle reenactments that took place that day, the most entertaining performance, as always, came from the Chiefs' sideline.
It's all out there in that field for us. In the next 60 minutes, we're going to get it all. World champions in professional football.
All right. Got to play.
Hank Stram was the very first person, player or coach, who was ever wired in a Super Bowl.
Let's go, boys. Hey, let's go, man.
NFL Films, at this point, was shooting all the games for both leagues as part of the merger agreement. And we had actually wired Hank Stram in a regular season game at Municipal. Was the Chiefs versus the Boston Patriots.
What are you doing in the huddle, Leonard? My God, what are you doing in that huddle all that time?
He better tuck that ball away. Put that ball away. Out. He's out. 1 foot was out.
We're just missing it that much every time. Every single time. We're that close.
Look at this cleat mark right here. Look at the cleat mark right there. 1 foot was out and the other one was off.
Well, geez, tell them to shut their big mouth and call them.
And it was one of the most hilarious and entertaining wires we'd ever had.
Was that there, Rich? Hey, was that there? Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I think that Ed Sable and Steve Sable, who had asked Hank to wear the wire, they thought that they had a potential gold mine there, and this just confirmed
it. Nice going there, Brindley.
In January of 1969, the upstart New York Jets shocked the football universe on a sunny afternoon in Miami, Florida, defeating the NFL's vaunted Baltimore Colts. In doing so, they notched the first Super Bowl win for the AFL and gave legitimacy to the supposed second-rate league for the very first time. 1 year later, it appeared most were still not convinced.
Even after Joe Namath and the Jets had upset the Colts in Super Bowl III, there was still a feeling that that was fluky, and the AFL was still the inferior league.
There was this sense that the leagues weren't really equal, but it was just this Jets win, you know?
So going into Super Bowl IV, the Vikings were huge favorites, 2-touchdown favorites.
When you look at it now, it's laughable. Any sane person would look at that now would say, what were these people thinking? But the prejudice against the AFL was so strong then.
We were very aware that this would be the last true AFL game, and we would be able to make it 2-2.
Some of these former players, it's so important for them because they had to prove all the time that they could compete for the big league, the NFL. I thought, I don't care what kind of game I have as long as we win.
For those guys who'd been around for the entire decade of the AFL, they had been hearing Mickey Mouse stuff and dismissals and things like that for all of their professional football career. You knew Hank remembered that. You knew Len Dawson and those other veterans remembered that. And this was their last chance at redemption.
Mr. Official, let me ask you something. Okay, Coach, go ahead. How can six of you miss a play like that, huh?
Hank seemed somewhat more animated during the game.
I wondered why he was being so joyous and chattering all of the time down there.
I thought you'd been on the field.
No. What? Yeah, Gasolki was running around there like it was a
He's engaging in that constant staccato banter.
Hey, Lenny!
Through the whole game.
It looks like he's like a football coach from Hollywood Central Casting who's just reading off lines that he's memorized from a screenwriter.
Hey, move it up a little bit. Pop it out of that end zone, yeah!
That's an excellent call. Those officials are doing a hell of a job.
Just keep matriculating the ball down the field, boys.
As their outspoken head coach patrolled the sidelines of the 69 Super Bowl, the Chiefs play on the field began to make even more noise.
They can't cover that in a million years.
The offense seemingly moved at will throughout the first half, and the Chiefs quickly jumped out to a 9-0 lead.
Well, the Minnesota Vikings, they were a very good football team, an outstanding defense, defensive front four particularly. But we were not in awe of them.
If we put things together, we'll kill these guys.
Look for 65 toss power trap. What does it look like?
Hey, look for...
Tell them 65 toss power trap. That might pop wide open, Rats.
They just felt that this is going to be a pushover. But they forgot to tell us.
Running play coming to Garrett on a trap. Touchdown! Garrett scores from the five.
Was that there, Rats? Nice going, Biggie.
With 5:34 remaining here before the half, Garrett took it in.
A 16-0 lead with the defense that we had against the Minnesota Vikings offense, there was no doubt in our mind.
multiple reports from that Super Bowl IV game is that when the Vikings went in to halftime trailing 16-0, Bud Grant did not spend a lot of time on the chalkboard, did not spend a lot of time talking about what are we doing that's not working. He told his team to just play harder. Contrasting that with Hank and the layered sense of strategic and tactical plans he had to attack the Vikings, it was like night and day.
That's it, boys. That's it, Rats. That's it, boys.
And here he was in his moment in the sun.
They didn't know where Mike was.
On a national stage.
Didn't know where he was.
In the final game of the AFL's history.
Coach pumped it in there, boys.
Completely out-coaching the Lombardi disciple on the other side of the field. And you could tell he was enjoying that.
I told you that baby was there. Yes, sir, boys. Woo!
We're number one, and don't you forget it, mister. We're the champions of the world. When the going gets the roughest, that's when the Chiefs are toughest. So be sensible and treat us with respect.
I think it's Ozzie Newsome of the Ravens said that the biggest threat to success is success. And I think some of that might have affected the Chiefs.
My father walked in and told the family, we were sitting in the living room, and said, I just want to let you know that I am no longer the head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs. And it was something that you kind of never thought that they would come.
I couldn't believe that they let Hank go, because Hank is a guy that molded me into a quarterback in professional football, gave me that opportunity. And I hated to see him go.
Hank Stram was all heart. I've always thought it was like the most human of things. He didn't want to believe that these guys couldn't do it one more time. That team could have easily been in three or four Super Bowls, and they could have won more than one of them. I mean, they were that good a team, and he didn't want to let go.
The fact was, the Chiefs were so successful in the second half of the 60s, when the common draft between the AFL and NFL comes into play, that they're not getting blue chip players that they were getting for the first half of the 60s. So you had a team that got older, and the next players coming up weren't better.
Hank Stram made headlines his entire career, and that renown followed him even after leaving Kansas City.
You know, Hank called me the night before he was going to take the job. He said, I'm taking this job because of you. Very disappointed that I was having arm trouble and had to miss a whole year. And didn't play a down for him his first year. And then in his second year, I missed four games. In those days, usually you had 4 or 5 years to build something. And he didn't have but 2 years.
In professional athletics, if you can go through your career without ever being let go from your position, that is pretty rare and pretty unique. But I think it challenged him to do other things, and I think that was he was better for it.
Well, they got bump and run on the outside receivers again. He's going to change the play.
Oh, there he is. Chandler is going to toss it into the end zone, and Chandler caught it! And it'll be first and goal from there. Hank, you really called it.
Ever since Super Bowl IV, when he agreed to let NFL Films mic him for that game against Minnesota, people realized that Hank would be a natural guy for the booth.
CBS Sports presents the National Football League.
With me, a fellow who knows all about the euphoria of victory, particularly in the Super Bowl, Hank Stram.
It was natural for him. He could see things developing in games.
He saw it through a coach's eye, but he spoke the way an announcer does.
I'm pleased this year to be working with the coach, Hank Stram. Hank, you've got the program all rolled up. I've never seen you so pumped up.
I couldn't sleep last night. I'm so excited. I can imagine what these kids are doing and these coaches are doing here this afternoon.
He took a lot of pride in it. I mean, big time pride in his career as a broadcaster. And I love that. I fed off of that.
Hank would prepare for his broadcast just like he would prepare when he was a head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs.
I think Hank was meticulous about the details from the way he dressed. I mean, he always had a sport coat on, maybe a red pocket square in honor of the Chiefs. He prepared like he was going to coach the game.
They'll throw the ball on first and 10. That's their personality, and they'll do it on this first play of the game. They do.
Montana throwing to the right side.
He brought to the booth this incredible ability to foreshadow a play.
We might see something outside on the first play from this formation. See if they run straight ahead if they run on this first play.
And he knew right away.
He'd say they're going to run right, and they would run right. They're going to run a hitch pass. They would run a hitch pass.
I think we're going to see an awful lot of that running to the right side.
Again, you're right, Hank.
That's a right side room.
All kinds of room. Touchdown, Green Bay.
Every week, that moment would come when the big play was about to happen, and he would, to a T, describe exactly what they were going to do. And I think that was brand new.
Third and three. We'll see a pick of some kind on the right side, possibly.
Montana looking, throwing in the end zone.
Well, I thought Hank was a good broadcaster. He'd prepare. He knew the game. He did a lot of our games after he left. I'd heard him a couple of times. He'd kind of predict what the first play of the game was going to be. Well, he always sent somebody down to me right before a kickoff, a runner, and say, Coach Stram wants to know what's going to be your first play. Hank was funny.
I'm going to initial it, but I don't know how I can give it to you because I might break the glass.
All right. Well, he put the roller skates on and got out of the pocket.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, it looked like it.
It seemed like Hank had a phrase for everybody and everything.
We, to this day, have our little Hank sayings. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, boys. Boys was a big thing.
He called me Charlie Chaplin. He'd say, toots a foots a goots. And I don't know whether that was his expression for Phyllis.
I think sometimes he's looking to arrest somebody that might catch him for speeding. And Thurman takes the swallow of the anchovy on the play.
People that didn't know him, and I was with friends, and they would look at me and say, what did that mean?
He had all these little quips and sayings that made life interesting. I mean, it was just a fascinating time.
Hank Stram's broadcasting career spanned 21 years and secured the nation's memory of his one-of-a-kind character. His ability to perceive the game as a coach and relate it to the everyday man separated him from his peers and connected him to the game he couldn't live without.
I think it was something that really enhanced his life. It gave him a completely different outlet to share his knowledge, his expertise, and his personality.
I love the man. I miss him. And I am very fortunate that I'm one of the few around today who could say that they got to share a booth with him.
Hank Stram's impact on football was nearly unparalleled. But more than 30 years after his historic win, his achievements were still not acknowledged by many, and his status as one of the game's greats had yet to be assured.
I always felt that he was overlooked in the early years of when he was eligible. And some of that, I think, was just a residual effect of people looking at the American Football League and not fully appreciating all that that league had accomplished.
It was, for so long, a gross oversight that Hank was not in the Hall of Fame. Thankfully, that wrong was righted.
When he finally made that that select few, it was kind of like winning Super Bowl IV, you know. It was a validation of what I already knew was true. They were that good, he was that good, he was that deserving.
It just should have happened early. I was so excited and happy for he and Phyllis and the entire family, but he was sick.
He had gotten to a point he was not very healthy. He was struggling with offshoots of diabetes. I hope that he understood that that award represented all of the things that he stood for all those years. That throughout all of that, that he was always the one that was driving the success of that football team.
The greatest coach in pro football, Hank Stram!
It's about winning, and how do you do it? That's Hank's legacy here at the Hall of Fame. Walk through and see the story of the Kansas City Chiefs, see their successes, and understand that he was the architect of those successes.
My privilege to introduce into the Hall of Fame mentor, friend, Hank Stram.
I think when I think of Hank Stram and his contributions, he understood that even though football could be a simple game, it was becoming in the 60s and 70s and 80s what it is today. I think you can see it in the multiple offenses of the 21st century. You can see it in the motion. You can see it in the shotgun. He's still part of the game today.
I think his real legacy was how he handled his people. He understood the football game. He understood the person.
These guys can't move the ball against us. Let's do the job on it, baby.
He understood that it was a game of people, and you had to reach people. You had to let them know you cared about them. You had to get them to feel as though they were playing for something larger than themselves.
My rookie year, one morning I had an awful practice. I missed more than I made, and I thought, well, maybe I can handle the pressure. Maybe not. I didn't have much experience. So I was very dejected, and I thought, well, maybe Hank is going to cut me. Maybe go with somebody else. I'm sitting there all alone, feeling sorry for myself. Here comes Hank out of and walking towards me, and I thought, here it comes. He looks at me and he says, you know, I think that you can become one of the best kickers in the history of pro football. And he walked away and disappeared around the corner. I couldn't wait to get back on that practice field again and show that he was right, that the belief that he had in me that I could possibly do that.
He was concerned about his players, not only when you played for him. Many times he called me up and said, hey, you need to call so-and-so. I heard he's not doing too good. This is the kind of coach he was.
He wasn't a screamer or intimidator. If you go out there and bust your fanny for him, he'd do anything in the world for you. I loved the man from when I first met him, and I felt that way, you know, every day that I ever played for the man.
The Chiefs Kingdom is a symphony of moments, images, connections, and each snapshot tells a story of her adventure.
In 2003, when I got voted into the Hall of Fame, I had been working on my book, America's Game, for like 3 years by then. And so I'd gotten to know Lamar Hunt. And so I sent a note to Lamar that summer and said, hey, wouldn't it be a nice touch for the Chiefs to sort of pay homage to Hank by, on the first play of the game at the Hall of Fame game, line up in the choir huddle, which was one of Hank's signatures. I guess the letter didn't reach Lamar in time, so they didn't do it, and it was fine. And I was going back to talk to Carl Peterson, the president and general manager of the Chiefs, and he said to me, hey, Lamar passed on that note. We're going to have the team huddle up in the choir huddle.
Well, I think it all started before the Pittsburgh game. As players, we didn't know a whole lot about it going into it.
I wasn't trying to suggest that you do it before an actual football game that counts.
You know, when you go back and you look at it now, it wasn't a real comfortable just getting everybody lined up because it's not the norm.
Chiefs fans, to honor Hank Stram, the Chiefs offense is huddling in the choir formation.
So we go out, we get everybody lined up, call the play. It's a two tight end formation, run play to Priest Holmes up the middle. I don't think it was super successful. We maybe picked up a couple of yards. So we call the second play.
And then Trent Green throws an interception that's returned for a pick six.
For an interception returned for a touchdown.
And I'm just like, oh. Fortunately, the Chiefs wound up winning the game.
Cuts it back right across the 35.
But I hope that Hank got to see that, and I hope that he appreciated that. And I was glad it didn't cost them the football game.
You know, he would put a little something into him, getting worried about that instead of the game.
Mm-hmm.
65 toss power trap.